With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Sabrina Halvorsen.
Good morning, and thank you for joining us on this Monday for the AgNet News Hour. Coming up later, how consumer preferences are changing and challenging the wine industry. And will homes of the future be built without kitchens? We'll have more on that as well. But our top story today, looking at drought conditions around the nation. The first U.S. drought monitor for this month indicates significant improvements in drought coverage over recent weeks. Rod Bain reports.
A downward trend in overall U.S. drought coverage at the start of December.
Our drought coverage is 34.4% of the country, just over one-third, and that is down from 4 weeks ago. In early November, we had 37.5% of the country covered in drought, so that is a month-over-month change of minus 3.1 percentage points, in other words, improvement in the drought situation.
USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey says all drought categories reflect month-over-month declines in drought coverage.
But even within that, there are some regional variability issues to talk about.
Such as marked improvement in areas such as the Pacific Northwest and Southern Gulf Coast, as well as worsening drought conditions in the Southern Plains and lower Midwest.
If you look at the country overall here and look at those lower 48 states, 20 of them still have some degree of the high-end drought coverage, D3s and D4s.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
And USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey looks at hay and cattle production areas covered in drought for the period ending December 5th.
Now, in terms of other things that we talk about with commodities and drought, first of all, we'll focus on the hay production area for the U.S. That number coming in on December 5th, 35% of the U.S. hay production area in drought. That is down significantly from a year ago when we were sitting at 57%. And at 35% is the lowest number we've seen since late August of 2023. And we are down from an autumn peak of 42% coverage. So again, most of the news there is good. Again, even though we still have a little more than a third of the hay production area in drought, those numbers have trended downward in recent weeks. Now we'll finish off this month with the cattle inventory in drought. That current number for the United States is 37%. Like just about every other commodity and crop, those numbers have come down over the last year. Early December 2022, 69% of the U.S. cattle inventory was in drought. The last time we saw a number below the current number of 37% was mid-August of 2023, and we're coming off an autumn peak of 47% of the U.S. cattle inventory in drought.
He says there are recent declines in extreme to exceptional drought coverage across the country.
No matter which drought categories you look at, the low-end drought or the higher-end drought, we have seen those decreases. And some of the most impressive decreases in drought coverage and intensity have been at the high levels of drought. So, for example, D4, the worst drought category, exceptional drought, we had about 2.5% of the country covered by exceptional drought in early November. That has since dropped to 1.2%, basically a halving of the D4 coverage over the last month. 20 of 48 states have at least some coverage of extreme or exceptional drought. For some of those states, it's very minimal coverage, 1% or less. In states like Oklahoma, as well as Minnesota, Missouri, Wisconsin, and Florida. But then on the high end of that, we still have significant drought coverage, even though we have seen some improving conditions in some of the Gulf Coast states. And so leading the country on December 5th with D3 to D4, extreme to exceptional drought coverage, still Louisiana. That hasn't changed from a month ago. The numbers have come down just a little bit. 87% coverage of D3 to D4 on December 5th. Next on the list is Mississippi coming in at 78%. Then as you move westward, we still have some fairly punishing drought in the southern Rockies and environs. New Mexico coming in on December 5th with 43% coverage of extreme to exceptional drought. Other states that are still in double digits for D3 to D4 coverage include Nebraska, Iowa, and then as you move into the southeast, we have Tennessee and Alabama.
In other news, the president has signed an executive order that will give tribes easier access to federal programs. Gary Crawford reports.
When I became president, I promised my administration would prioritize respect for tribal sovereignty and self-determination.
President Biden telling the Tribal Nations Summit in Washington Wednesday that there has been progress toward that goal. He said there are today many, many federal loan and grant programs available for which tribal communities can apply.
But today, there are still too many hoops to jump through, too many strings attached and too many inefficiencies in the process.
He said many tribal organizations and governments don't have the time or staff to complete all of the complex application paperwork.
That's why today I'm signing an executive order to reform the federal funding system for tribes, cutting that red tape so you can deliver for your community faster and better.
The order requires federal agencies to streamline the program application process, cut back on unnecessary reporting requirements, and the order also creates an online clearinghouse where tribal governments can search for all available federal programs all in one place. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
This is the AgNet News Hour. We will return in just a moment with more agriculture news. You're listening to the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. I'm Sabrina Halverson. In today's National Spotlight, in its 100th year, FarmAll is giving a glimpse of what's in store for the next century. Chad Smith has the story.
Earlier in 2023, Case IH unveiled the FarmAll 75C Electric, the smartest electric tractor from Case IH. They also launched numerous tractors like the FarmAll 25SC Subcompact, FarmAll 25A, and FarmAll M. Terry Zanella, campaign manager for tractors with Case IH, talks about the FarmAll 75C Electric.
The FarmAll 75C Electric is our first fully electric utility vehicle with autonomous features. It has diesel-like performance with its horsepower and torque, but yet since it's battery operated, it is so quiet, it's comfortable, it has zero exhaust emissions and a 4-hour runtime. The electric engine gave us an opportunity to introduce easy to use autonomous features that are unprecedented. And this tractor is going to be perfect for like vineyards and orchards, municipalities, or really any enclosed livestock facilities.
The easy-to-use autonomous features in the FarmAll 75C Electric will benefit farmers.
The autonomous features on our FarmAll 75C Electric will allow for more efficient completion of daily tasks. You can have comprehensive monitoring of surrounding people and objects. One of the features is what we call invisible bucket. So this gives views of the front of the bucket, around the bucket, and through the bucket. This is going to be a huge benefit when using the loader. Another feature is what we call follow me mode, which does just that. The tractor has the ability to follow the operator when they're out of the cab in either forward or reverse. This is going to be great for opening and closing gates, picking up rocks, or fixing, repairing fence lines.
She talks about where the 25SC subcompact tractor fits into their lineup.
The subcompact is an all-purpose, affordable tractor for the consumer, rural lifestyler, or farmer on a red farm that wants the addition of a subcompact. It has a lot of benefits of a large tractor, but it's in a small package. The tractor has both a rear and a mid PTO, so you can mow grass, you can plow snow, you can dig holes, move dirt, really a number of tasks around your property.
The FarmAll 100th anniversary celebration included a contest in which the winner gets a FarmAll 75C.
After a lot of consideration, they selected Steve Wilson as the winner. Steve's story is so inspiring. He has a life, you know, dedicated to farming. Case IH tractors were part of the foundation of his family farm since he was born. Later in life, Steve battled a couple of rounds of cancer and really found that being on his FarmAll helped him mentally escape his health issues. So at that time, it was just him and his tractor. When we asked Steve how he would use the 75C, he said, like any good man, he would help his wife with her projects.
For more information, visit caseih.com or talk with your local Case IH dealer. Chad Smith reporting.
USDA is out with its new agricultural trade forecast for 2024. Here's Gary Crawford with more.
How does the USDA's top economist describe the prospects for U.S. food and farm product exports for this current fiscal year?
Trade is still good, still strong, maybe not as robust as it was for a couple years.
Agriculture Department Chief Economist Seth Meyer of the USDA just put out its ag trade forecast for the 2024 fiscal year that began October 1st. Now, to put this in perspective, in fiscal year 2021, U.S. agricultural exports were just under $172 billion. Last year, a record high $193 billion. And Seth Meyer gave us the new projection for fiscal 2024.
For fiscal year 24, exports are at $169.5 billion, mostly on lower grain and animal product values. Imports, we got higher by $500,000 than previously forecast, and mostly an increase on beef, vegetable oil, and grain products. And those imports now stand at an even $200 billion, and exports of $169.5 billion. So there is a trade deficit in there.
A $30 billion trade deficit if these USDA projections for 2024 hold up. And indeed, for now and the foreseeable future,
you've got imports generally growing faster than exports.
In fact, as you heard earlier, exports are actually falling as far as dollar values go. Meyer says there are probably several possible reasons for that.
Some might be the strength of the U.S. dollar. Some might be better performance of the U.S. economically than some of our trading partners around the world in terms of GDP growth. Some of it might be changes in the market and things we're always worried about, which is competitiveness.
Because a strong dollar makes our products generally more expensive on world markets compared to the same products from competing countries. So that reduces our exports. And then flip that around, the strong dollar also making foreign products less expensive for U.S. consumers to buy. And on that score,
I think you've got strong U.S. consumer base that feels like it wants a diverse diet.
And because the economy is growing, consumers have the money to buy more imported items. And Seth Meyer told us, frankly,
it's going to be a challenge for us to get back to a consistent export surplus situation.
Especially with our ag exports expected to be below last year for just about every major commodity. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you just need to get the news at a different time, you can subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search for Agnet NewsHour on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's Agnet NewsHour, and it is available on Apple and Android devices. This is the Agnet NewsHour, and I'm Sabrina Halverson. We will return in just a moment with more agriculture news and farm features when we get back. Coming up in a few moments, we'll have today's This Land of Ours report, but first, more of the day's agriculture news. And with today's Agnet West headlines, here's Brian German.
Two new studies have been released to help Central Coast growers in estimating costs and returns for organically and conventionally produced processing apples. The studies have been released by UCANR, UC Cooperative Extension, and UC Davis Department of Ag and Resource Economics and are available for free download. The studies provide baseline estimates for growers to assess costs related to production loans, labor, market arrangements, water and nutrient management, and regulatory programs. The management scenario models cover a 100-acre farm detailing cultural practices, land preparation, soil fertility, pest management, irrigation, and labor needs. The studies include cost breakdowns, ranging analysis, and potential profits over various prices and yields. The new studies, along with others, are available at coststudies.ucdavis.edu. The Effective Food Procurement Act proposes a values-based approach for the USDA in purchasing commodities for nutrition programs. The legislation aims to shift from a concentration of contracts with a few corporations to a more diverse range of producers. The act would direct USDA to prioritize purchases from beginning veteran and socially disadvantaged farmers, small and mid-sized operations, ag cooperatives, organic producers, and those employing environmentally sustainable and worker-friendly practices. The bill would establish a pilot program to gradually transition USDA practices, incorporating values-based evaluation criteria beyond cost considerations. Additionally, it would require estimating greenhouse gas emissions associated with purchased food, evaluating bids on climate impact and worker well-being, and enhancing transparency in the procurement process. USDA has released a new forecast for this year's farm income. Administrator of USDA's Economic Research Service, Spiro Stefano, shared the numbers for the forecasted net cash farm income for calendar year 2023.
It is forecast at nearly $158 billion, which is down about 21% relative to 2022. Of course, 2022 was a record net cash farm income year.
2023 cash receipts are set to decrease about 4.7%.
Now, that's following a forecast increase in 2022 that was record about 22.5%. So these farm cash receipts are down. So both crop and animal product receipts are forecast to decrease. And the largest dollar decreases are forecast for milk, corn, broilers, eggs, hogs, and soybeans.
Consumer preferences are posing some challenges for the wine industry. President of Allied Grape Growers, Jeff Bitter, said multiple factors are preventing wine consumption levels from achieving significant growth.
There's become a much bigger anti-alcohol movement over the last few years. You know, we benefited from health messaging that was positive about red wine when it's consumed in moderation could be good for your health, but we don't have that momentum now. It's kind of ran its course. That was, you know, 30 years ago now, and this generation doesn't get that messaging. Most of the messaging they receive has to do with, you know, alcohol being bad for you in any quantity. So that's a headwind we face. And then wine is just generally more expensive than the alternative alcohol beverages. Per serving, it's going to be more expensive than beer in most cases, and spirits or any kind of mixed drink. So we face the challenge there, just the price competitiveness and being able to attract consumers' attention.
CDFA's granted over $500,000 for a project led by Dr. Mark Hoddle at UC Riverside. The two-year, two-month project is part of the sixth funding cycle of the Proactive Integrated Pest Management Solutions Program. The project aims to develop a proactive low-impact control program for the South American palm weevil, an invasive pest threatening California's date palm industry. The initiative, titled Development of a Proactive IPM Program for the California Date Industry, focuses on optimizing the attract-and-kill strategy, utilizing pheromone-baited traps to lure and eliminate pests. The CDFA's Proactive IPM program anticipates potential exotic pest threats, developing and testing low-impact management strategies to enhance California's biosecurity preparedness and align with the state's sustainable pest management roadmap, ultimately reducing reliance on broad-spectrum pesticides. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
We are now in those months that feature holidays and special celebrations in which food is a big feature, all the way from
Halloween,
yes, to Thanksgiving, to Christmas and Hanukkah, and then New Year's, and we might as well throw in the Super Bowl. One expert calls this 2.5 month period of time the marathon of food.
It really just kind of stacks one holiday on the other without a lot of time to get back into a normal routine in between.
Kansas State University Extension consumer science expert Sherilyn Jackson says all these celebrations feature food in a big role. And, oh, speaking of big roles,
some people will put on even 5 to 10 pounds over this holiday time, but most of the time people put on only 1 or 2.
Well, that doesn't sound that bad, 1 or 2.
But the problem is that we put on a little bit of extra weight, but then we're not taking that off. So the next year you put on a couple more, and the following year you put on a couple more.
It's all those special big family meals and extra goodies and parties and buffet lunches and buffet dinners. Sherilyn says just a little planning and thinking ahead, though, could make this holiday food marathon less likely to expand our waistlines. She says if you know that later in the day you've got a big meal or party with a lot of food that will be available, don't save up all day and starve yourself before the event. Instead, just ahead of the event,
have a healthy snack of some sort before you go so that you're not just really, really hungry.
And also, when you first arrive for that meal or party,
start with a glass of water or iced tea or a low-cal or non-cal beverage before you start eating, and that'll help you feel a little bit more full as well.
And if there's an option, use a smaller plate. And for the first go-round,
just pick things that you know are going to be healthy type foods like salads and fruits and veggies, some low fat meat, that type of thing. And then go back if you want, if this is with your smaller plate again, come back a second time and have just a small portion of those other things.
You know, those other things. And throughout any eating experience, Sherilyn says slow down.
Pace yourself and realize that it takes a good 10 to 20 minutes before your brain signals to your stomach that you're full.
Stomach to brain, don't send any more food down here. We can't take it.
So basically in all this, Sherilyn says the key is not going on automatic during the holiday food marathon.
plan ahead, visualize, this is what I'm going to do when I approach the buffet, and think it through before you go. And that way you're more apt to follow through.
And not gain so much weight between now and the day after that
Super Bowl. Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
This is the AgNet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. We will return in just a moment with more agriculture news. You are listening to the AgNet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. The application period for interested participants of USDA's first Ag Trade Mission of 2024 is now underway through December 18th. Rod Bain has more.
December 18th is the deadline for interested U.S. ag exporters, state ag department and commission representatives, and commodity and trade organizations to apply to be part of USDA's first agricultural trade mission of 2024.
To Seoul, South Korea, the trade mission is going to take place March 25th through 28th.
Ryan Brewster of the Foreign Agricultural Service says South Korea was our nation's sixth largest ag export market in 2022.
With lots of exciting trade and things like beef and pork, dairy, and then upcoming kind of trading things that are growing, like prepared foods and consumer-ready products.
Undersecretary for Trade and Foreign Agricultural Affairs Alexis Taylor will head the delegation. More information about the upcoming South Korea Ag Trade Mission is available online at www.fas.usda.gov/topics. Click on the link to trade missions. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
After an open start to the fall harvest season, mild, wet weather has set in for much of central and eastern Canada. Soybean harvest has pretty well wrapped up in Ontario and Quebec, but many central regions and eastern regions are waiting for colder temperatures so that final corn acres can be harvested on the frost. Here's Dennis Guy.
Much of Atlantic Canada had a rainy summer, and that wet weather continued into fall harvest. Ryan McCarron operates a mixed beef cattle, forage, and cash crop corn and barley operation in Antigonish, Nova Scotia. Antigonish is on the Northumberland Strait and is located just across the water southeast of Prince Edward Island. Ryan McCarron still has several hundred acres of corn to get off. His main concern is that a snow squall will cover the ground and insulate it from a frost freeze-up. McCarron says it's been a long stop-and-go harvest season in Atlantic Canada.
Every other day it's been raining. It's been a bit of a challenge. Big rain events too, you know, you get 2-3 inches in an event and then drizzle the rest of the week. So we're at the stage now where you just got to get it off. Like, we're so close to the water here that we get a lot of snow effect. You kind of get into the issue where you won't get freeze up. You'll get snow before you'll get freeze up, and then the issue just kind of compounding.
Ryan McCarron says that nearly all of his heavy clay land is systematically tiled, and that investment has paid off this year. McCarron reports that his corn yields have been average. He's surprised this year's yields have held up as well as they have with the long stretches of wet weather.
Surprisingly not bad for how wet it's been. For the most part, average or maybe just a below average. For our area, if you're getting like 4 ton to the acre, kind of what you kind of hit for, and it hasn't been too far off that. 90% of my land is all systematically tiled. Then we're on some custom stuff at certain places, and some ground's not tiled, some of it is. And there's not much drainage, there's nothing there.
In the Great Lakes region of southwestern Ontario, an open harvest season has given way to wet weather with milder days and frosty nights. Eric Dietrich rotates corn, soybeans, and winter wheat just north of London, Ontario, located between Lake Erie and Lake Huron. Dietrich says he's nearly finished corn harvest. The Dietrich operation has been combining in the dark over the last couple of weeks when the frost has helped keep the equipment up out of the mud.
We're down to the last couple hundred acres here. We've had rainfall. We've also had snowfall. The snow seemed to slow you down more. We're fortunate, I guess, with our own grain system too, so we can kind of tailor our hours to when field conditions are right. End up doing a lot in the dark, but I guess that's why they put lights on stuff.
Reporting from Canada, I'm Dennis Guy.
A super El Nino is affecting Brazil, causing problems during planting. David Geiger has this report.
Adverse weather in Brazil is reducing yields, but the country is still expected to produce a record soybean crop. Joanna Calusi with the Department of Agricultural and Consumer Economics at the University of Illinois says dry weather looks to reduce the bean crop by around 280 million bushels.
Some industry experts, they believe a record crop is still possible, others not anymore.
CONAB, the national supply company of Brazil, still predicts a record 162 million metric tons, or 5.9 billion bushels of soybeans this year. That's about 250 million bushels more than last year. Calusi says the increase would be due to planted area, 3% higher, now expected at more than 111 million acres. All predictions on yields are difficult due to what she calls a super El Nino.
After three consecutive growing seasons under La Nina influence, this crop season is being very different. Generally speaking, the effects of El Nino are the opposite from La Nina for South America.
That means dry weather in north and central Brazil with more rain in Argentina and southern Brazil, according to Clusi. So far in Mato Grosso, the dry weather forced replanting in some areas. Lucy says the 2023 to 2024 planting season continues behind last year's level of 86%, only 75% done as of the end of November.
And the current pace was the lowest for the period since 2019-20 crop season.
Calusi says the delay in soybean planting also has another impact, the safrinha, or second crop, which is about 70% of Brazilian corn production.
Many farmers could dismiss planting corn in the second season due to the high climate risk. The window to plant corn as a second season is very short in Brazil because of the dry season in the center west that usually starts in middle April. That means that farmers, they should be able to plant the safrinha in ideal conditions in January and February.
Production is expected to be down by 10%, according to CONAB. I'm David Geiger.
This is the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. We will return in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back to the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Chuck Zimmerman brings us today's interview segment. Here's Chuck.
I'm visiting with Dave Armstrong, and Dave, I know you're chairman for ASTA. Tell us, first of all, a little bit about yourself and your company.
So I'm the president and CEO of Cicada America Holding Company, so I'm responsible for all of Cicada's activity in North America, Central America, and some parts of South America and Oceania. Cicada is a 110-year-old publicly traded company focusing in vegetable and flower genetics, and we're based in California. We're actually going through a process now, moving our headquarters from Morgan Hill, California, just south of San Jose, up towards Woodland near Sacramento. So that's a big move going on in the company now. But we've been established in the U.S. for nearly 50 years and have enjoyed a lot of success in developing genetics in the vegetable space for the U.S. and Mexico market especially.
So, as chairman, when does that change to in your term?
So the term is 1 year as chairman, and it begins in July 1 and goes through June. That's our year. But ASTA really has you make a commitment to the board in this process. We call it three up, three down. So you're basically making a 6-year commitment to the board, right? So as vice chair, then second vice to vice, and then chair, and then you remain on the board for a couple of years. But yeah, it's a 1-year commitment as chairman.
Well, I congratulate you on that. What I would like to talk about a little bit is this newly named conference. I'm still trying to say it fluently, but the Field Crop Seed Convention here. How has that name change gone well with members?
The name change seems to be going okay, but I think you pointed to, right, the change pain is always going to be there. I mean, this has been known for decades as CSS, so certainly we don't expect people to just automatically get the new name, but I think it better conveys what goes on at this convention, and so far we're not seeing any real resistance to the new name.
How about the venue? I mean, 40 years in the same hotel. I think Cindy and I, who are doing work for you all. This is our 12th one of these. So, yeah, we were kind of used to that, too. But as Bruce Knight said here this morning on his panel, this is climate change. He was joking about the weather here versus up there. But we do have pretty good weather.
Weather has been a big factor in the decision here to move to Florida, of course, right? But there were other things, with the Chicago venue that made it really not sustainable, I think, in future costs, weather, difficulty in just setting up and managing the logistics of the event. So that is all pointed to this this significant move. And for sure, it's a milestone in this kind of keystone event of ASTA. So far, so good. We'll see. I mean, it's our first first run here in Orlando, and the feedback I'm getting from attendees is generally positive. Some folks have pointed out some things that we can improve on with the venue, with the approach to the show. We're going to be taking that to our event management team, our excellent event management team, and looking for ways that we can improve this going forward. But so far, so good.
Yeah, that, and I think that's to be expected. There's probably going to be a survey, and I could see that there are things that people may make suggestions, and that happens every year, really. I've seen this event, even over those years, have some major changes at times. So how about talking about the organization itself? What right now, as you are going to leave here, are the things, issues, whatever you're going to be working on as you move forward?
Well, we just sat through a really interesting panel on conservation and cover crops. That's certainly one of the things that ASTA has been spending a lot of time on, because that's an emerging and rapidly evolving segment for the seed industry. Treated seed is another issue that's really important for the industry. That's increasingly being targeted by, kind of opponents of agriculture. The farm bill, obviously, we spend a lot of time asked to, our elite, policy team spent a lot of time on the farm bill, making sure that we just protect the free movement of seed around the world, and also innovation, that the regulatory environment around innovation is not constraining, some of these really important techniques like gene editing and others that are becoming increasingly important to developing new genetics to serve farmers and ultimately provide a secure and affordable food supply to everyone.
Do you have work being done at all on this whole thing called carbon and the sequestration of carbon, and has that had an impact on some of the things that you're doing?
Well, again, ASTA spends a lot of time on the broad area of sustainability. We've recently added, a sustainability pillar to the ASTA strategic plan. And, of course, we're working with our member companies who have varying, degrees of sort of sophistication in their sustainability programs. But to be sure, this is something that we'll be involved in monitoring and helping to develop as we go forward, because it's going to be an increasingly important part of the sort of agriculture industry's ability to adapt to this new world of measuring carbon output and again, as we heard in this very interesting panel, there's a lot of advanced programs already in process there, and for sure this is going to evolve. So yeah, it's an important area for ASTA, absolutely.
Well, another important area is this word called leadership, and that's another program that you've put together, and sounds to me like a great one for some of the member companies to get involved with some of their staff, for example.
Absolutely, and we are really excited about the ASTA Leadership Summit coming up next June in Nashville, Tennessee, just a really exciting venue. We have been working on that leadership summit over these last few years to adapt it to the needs of the seed industry. So again, while there are many leadership programs out there, the ASTA Leadership Summit does provide kind of that unique angle for the seed industry and for ASTA itself to draw folks into ASTA, especially, newer or emerging leaders in organizations to get involved in the industry. We're excited about the direction the summit has been going over these past couple of years, and we're particularly excited about the Nashville event coming up in June next year. So we really urge all people interested in leadership organized around the seed industry to join the event next year.
Before we close, anything else you'd like folks to know about ASTA that we didn't touch on?
ASTA's in great health. We have great leadership with Andy Levine and again, a really dynamic staff. They do a tremendous amount of work for the industry. We try to tell that story every day, but a lot of our members, of course, are busy, you know, running their businesses and may or may not be aware of that. But, you know, your organization is an important part of keeping the seed industry viable. And I'm excited to be part of ASTA and certainly part of the leadership.
Well, thank you very much, Dave, for taking time to visit with me here. We are at the ASTA Field Crop Seed Convention. I'm Chuck Zimmerman reporting.
Thank you, Chuck. This is the AgNet NewsHour, and we will return in just a moment. Wrapping up today's AgNet NewsHour, if you are still hunting for that perfect Christmas tree, what can you expect to find in terms of supply and price? Gary Crawford tells us.
If you are one of the over 22 million of us buying a real Christmas tree this year, what can we expect supplies to be like? What will the prices be like? Last year, Christmas tree shoppers were hit with a pretty hefty price hike compared to 2021. Christmas Tree Association Executive Director Tim O'Connor says the median price that we paid in 2021 was about $70, but in 22 it was $80. So what about this year?
Well, we would anticipate it would probably go up a little bit, but not as significantly as it did last year.
Tim says growers last year were hit with a 70% hike in their fuel prices, 200% increase in fertilizer prices, and O'Connor says yes, for growers this year,
there has been additional inflation, but not at the rapid pace we saw in 2022. And so we don't hear that they're passing on big price increases.
But, of course, if we buy from a retailer or a charitable group, they set the final price we pay, and obviously
a lot of pricing is out of the grower's hands.
It is. Of course, for some Christmas tree aficionados, money is not the object, usually. They just want the exact perfect tree for their home, just the right species, the right look, the right size. So with that in mind, we have been hearing this message through social media and broadcast news. The message is, shop early to find that perfect Christmas tree before they are all gone. Now, we're hearing that message a lot this year, but why? Well, Tim O'Connor has the story. First, because of high demand and limited tree production, most growers these days are selling their trees, all of their trees, and making a profit at it. But it was a different story 10 to 15 years ago.
At that time, the growers were not profitable. They were in an oversupply situation. Too many trees had been planted for the demand that existed, and growers were selling at below break-even prices.
So they cut plantings of new trees, and that has produced tight supplies of trees now over the last couple of years. O'Connor says, though, never fear.
You know, we will see more trees come into the marketplace in the future. They're planted. They're growing. I've seen them, and in the not-too-distant future, there will be more trees to harvest every year than we're currently experiencing.
Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
That's today's top agriculture news. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Thank you for sharing your morning with us.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Brian German and Sabrina Halverson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet NewsHour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.